You're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMMLP, Burlington, Vermont. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and this is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors. I'm back after a little bit of a break. Good to be back. Today on Write the Book, you will hear an interview with novelist and publishing consultant Kim McQueen. I did speak to Kim once before in 2014 with her business partner Cindy Barnes, but this time we're talking about Kim's writing. Kim does serve as vice president of Barnes McQueen Publishing Resources and Champlain Books, based in Burlington, Vermont. She is the author of two books, Out, Out, released in 2011, and then the book that we're going to talk about today, which is People Who Hate America, a novel that came out in the fall of 2014. People Who Hate America concerns the 1967 Newark, New Jersey race riots and the involvement of Hugh Adonisio, who was mayor of Newark, New Jersey at that time. Kim McQueen, whose maiden name was Adonisio as well, developed an interest in this story when she discovered that Hugh Adonisio had been a distant cousin. As she dug into Hugh's story, Kim began a journey into the events that sparked one of the pivotal race riots in our country's history. People Who Hate America is a novel tinged with stories of the mob, Sinatra tunes, Italian dinners, and hushed conversations in the mayor's office. This fictionalized account leads readers on a tour through the intricacies that eventually led up to the cataclysmic events of July 12, 1967. When I spoke with Kim McQueen earlier this week, I asked her to start by expanding a little on her decision to write about Hugh Adonisio and the 67 race riots in Newark, New Jersey.
From the time I found out about Hugh and realized that I might be related to him, until I eventually wrote about him something like 16 years later, I was kind of obsessed with his story. I was really obsessed with his story. Like, I would go to dinner parties and talk to my friends incessantly about this, to the point where they would say, finally, why don't you just write a book or get a grant or do something, you know. And so I realized that I had begun, you know, I sort of sounded obsessive in a really kind of fun writerly way, but it was fun and writerly just to me, and I think it was just annoying to everybody else. So I was stuck for a while because I didn't know how to write about him. This is somebody who lived, who, like I say, may have been related to me, so I spent a lot of time trying to find out, was he really related to me or not? Adonisio, I don't think, is a common name, but it's common enough that there was a guy in Hugh Adonisio's administration who worked for him named Frank Adonisio, who was actually indicted with him. And all of the news reports say, well, Frank Adonisio was no relation to Hugh Adonisio. They probably both came from the same area in Naples. So I could never really find out if I was really related to him. So that obsessed me for a while. And then...
And your maiden name was Adonisio.
Yes. I grew up Kim Adonisio, but did not know that this person may have been my relation until I found his name on a list of alumni at Fordham University Law School. So I spent a lot of time just walking around thinking about wanting to write about him. And I started researching him on the internet in 1996, when you could use Google to search things, but I couldn't find much. And I realized that, like, every year, if I searched the same string of words every year, I would get more stuff back.
Right.
And then the Star Ledger in Newark did a series on the riots themselves around by 2000, I don't know, early 2000s. And that put a whole lot more information sort of out there for me to find.
Okay.
And then the New Jersey Historical Society did an exhibit in their gallery space right in downtown Newark. And that was the place, was one of the places where I got the inkling finally that Hugh, who was mayor at the time, people actually blamed him for the riots taking place. And there was some language in the indictment documents for corruption that happened to also mention that there were people who blamed the mayor personally for the riots. So then I was off on a whole nother obsessive exploration. So I walked around thinking about how to write about this for a long, long time.
When did you start the book?
When I had coffee with a friend who was another, it was a member of my writing group, and she had, sustained the conversation with me over a couple of cocktails, and finally she said, "You and I are going to go to lunch. We're going to talk about this." So I said, "Great." So we went to lunch, and she said, "All right, here's what we're going to do. You're going to write this as a novel." Because I couldn't decide whether or not to write it as fiction or nonfiction. I didn't feel like I had the credentials to take on a non, or the time, or the funding to take on a big nonfiction project. So she said, "You're going to write it as a novel." And I said, but. She said, "Just write it as a novel." You know, National Novel Writing Month was coming up. And she said, "Just write it as a novel." And I said, but. She said, "Just do it. Yeah. I'm your coach. Just write 1,000 words by tomorrow." And I went, "Okay." And that's how I started.
Are you glad you wrote it as a novel?
Yeah, I am. That was really the only thing that sort of got me off the starting line and made me begin.
Well, it gives you the freedom to not know.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
So certain things that you've been researching for 15, 20 years that you didn't know, maybe you weren't going to be able to know.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
Okay. Your narrators are, they all surround Hugh, but Hugh does not, in fact, have a voice in the book. How did you decide to do that, and how did you choose your narrators?
That was another thing that I sort of walked around for years thinking about. And we actually had a wonderful writing retreat a couple of years ago, when I spent the whole time not writing, but actually just walking around, thinking about this narrator. I realized, after a couple of false starts writing in Hugh's voice, that what in fact attracted me to him in the first place was the fact that he was totally unknowable. Here is a guy who has 6 children. He goes to church. He has many, 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 many friends who have helped him get to elected office, who wanted him to be governor. And yet, there was a large group of people who probably rightfully believed he was to blame for setting these conditions in place that sparked these riots. So he was so unknowable. How do you have, I mean, how does that work? And I wasn't able to go and interview him, you know. And so I thought, well, that's what it is about this guy that makes me want to write about him. I don't know who he is. And I thought, I bet the people around him at the time didn't know either. I bet his wife had certain parts of him that she couldn't get to. And I bet his chief of staff only knew like 30 or 40% of him. He only knew the sort of the work, the political hue. Mm-hmm. And then a bunch of his mom friends, because he had friends who were in the underworld. And I bet they didn't know him really well. And I thought, well, what if I just tell his story from their point of view, and then it'll be really obvious how limited their view of him is. And then if I put these all together, I'll have this sort of composite view of this person. They'll be able to offer a couple different perspectives of how this person, who was a church-going family man, could have fostered this culture of outright corruption that caused the riots.
Mm-hmm. Okay. You begin with his wife, Gloria, and she shows up throughout the book, and she was a character that I just was always happy to reconnect with. I wanted more of Gloria every time, you know. She's just great. So why did she have the most prominent voice in some ways? And maybe you don't think she had the most prominent voice. Maybe that's just me projecting how much I enjoyed reading her. But talk about Gloria.
So if what I'm trying to do is show how the central character of the mayor is unknowable, how better to do that than through the voice of his wife? And but at the same time, you can't set up these characters that are just there to be mirrors of the main character. I started to wonder as a writer, and I knew my readers would wonder, well, who is this woman and why is she married to him? And what does she tell herself every day? You know, what's going on through her mind the night that the riots happen and Hugh gets a call at his house at 1 a.m?
Right.
How much does she know about her own husband's mob connections? And then I sort of got into thinking, well, what's the life of a housewife in the early 60s? She lives out in the suburbs in a beautiful house in New Jersey. She has 6 children. I wanted to investigate what her life was like. And I was able then to have a much more well-rounded story because I could sort of live through her eyes, tell the story through her eyes. And I decided, I'm not sure if I decided that Gloria was going to be kind of depressed because that made sense to me. Maybe that's just because
6 kids.
if I envision myself in that space, right, I think I might be depressed.
Well, and that time, you know, that space and time, like, you know, having 6 kids in the 60s is
right,
about, that's what your life is about entirely. And
right,
maybe that's very gratifying to some people, but
right,
that's tough. I'm going to come back to Gloria in a minute,
okay,
but I wonder, did any narrators that you started to write not make the cut in the end?
I made a list of characters early on, and the characters that I eventually ended up setting the story on their shoulders, so to speak, was a lot smaller because I realized that, you know, if you're going to have multiple narrators or multiple points of view, you have to really pay attention to winnowing that down as much as possible. So if you've got characters with multiple points of view sort of milling around your book, it can be really, you know, it's a really short step to from that to having like too many people and your reader doesn't know sort of what's going on or who's talking.
Right. And they're losing track of the names. And
right.
Yeah.
I didn't want this to become like a Russian novel. You know, so I settled on just a few people and tried to get them know them really well. And that worked because then I could show sort of ancillary characters through my main character's eyes.
Mm-hmm.
I have the characters of Donnie and Clara, and they're a young couple, and he works for the mayor's office. And there was a while there where I thought, well, I'll also write in Clara's voice, you know, because I want to see what Clara has to say. But then I had to dial back on that because, you know, that sort of would have diluted from the character of Donnie. And so I realized the way to make those characters stronger was to put a lot on their shoulders and see the world through their eyes. Because it would have felt gimmicky, I think, if I had just used them as mirrors for Hugh as the main character. I would have ended up with something that was really hard for a reader to follow.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, you just mentioned something about Clara, and that brings me to a question. Clara's love of rock and roll, mm-hmm, is really similar to what Donnie hears coming from the homes of what he calls the colored families, which, mm-hmm, is, of course, the language of the time, the terminology of the time. I love that you included this detail. It felt like a very subtle way to show African-American culture as part of Donnie's life,
mm-hmm,
and his love of and respect of Clara and just living in the world. He has access to this culture. And later it's going to become important as he is tested in his sort of loyalty to the mayor.
Yeah.
And so I really enjoyed that. And,
thank you.
I just wonder if you can talk about, do you remember putting that little detail in the book, and was that purposeful, or was that just something that came out of your understanding of Clara?
No, I think what I was trying to get to was the idea that, you know, the mayor's a certain age. He's late 40s, early 50s, I think, when this all starts to happen. And he's been elected mayor for the second time, and he's sort of becoming a part of the establishment. And this young guy goes to work for him, and he has a little bit younger girlfriend. And so, what I wanted to sort of comment on was that, you know, even within the mayor's office, there are people of different generations who I think were much more able to see what was happening on the ground in these African American communities than the mayor really ever was.
Mm-hmm.
I see the mayor and his friends as sort of almost one generation, and people who worked for Hugh who were sort of coming up and starting their careers seemed to have a much better hold on what was actually going on in the black communities. And I think the mayor at the time, and I think this really went on, he really seemed to think that he was reaching down to pull up as many African Americans from the surrounding community and give them jobs, as many as he possibly could. And his point when he was interviewed about it seemed to be, you know, I'm doing the best I can here. He said one time, it was a quote, they don't seem to be content to just grow their station gradually. They want the whole ball game, right? And you know, that was a direct quote in the New York Times. And I could see the point of view of his chief of staff, who was 15 years younger. Well, you know, that's not how it works.
Mm-hmm.
That's not what we're being asked to do.
Mm-hmm.
We're being asked to be much more transparent. They're not asking for this or that token job. They're asking to be included in the decision making and not shut out.
Right, right, right. Yeah. Donnie has this love of his job and this sort of like putting Hugh on a pedestal at the beginning sort of thing. And then there's this gradual disillusionment that seems to come over him as the plot goes on. I wondered if you could talk a little bit more about developing his character.
So Donnie is based on a man who is still alive today, who was the mayor's chief of staff during this time. And I got to watch video interviews of him that the Star Ledger put up in the early 2000s. And so he's very much based on a real guy who I've never met.
Okay. Did he have a girlfriend named Clara?
He did not.
Okay.
Well, no, I don't know. I don't think so. I based my character on what I was able to gather of a real guy. This real guy has worked in public health for his entire career. He has made a life out of running nonprofit organizations that are designed to meet the public health needs of the population in Newark. He's still in Newark.
Mm-hmm.
He still works in Newark. And so I didn't have to make much up about him at all. I did need to answer the questions, like, why did he stay there?
Mm-hmm.
And my writing group was just excellent at helping me focus on this character, because I would bring in drafts of chapters about this character specifically, and I would think it was all there. I would think I was done, and that they would say, well, why does he do that? Why does Donnie stay? Why does Donnie take the mayor at face value? Why would he possibly why would he stick around? You know, he's smart enough that he can see what's going on. He's sniffing out the corruption every day as he goes into work. Why does he keep going back into work?
Right, right.
And in fact, he is the guy. There's a New York Times article that I found that was kind of chilling, that described the scene in the mayor's office with him and his chief of staff, and they get a call from across the street. The federal courthouse was across the street, and his chief of staff got a call, put the phone down, and said, "Mayor, they want you across the street now. You're being indicted."
Mm.
So he's the guy who delivers that news, you know, and walks across the street with the mayor. So I would bring these chapters in, writing from the character of the chief of staff, and I would have this idea of the of his character that hadn't really made it onto the page, and my writing group members would say, "You know, it's not really here. You know, we know you know this character, but you need to show him more."
Yeah.
And I knew that this was a guy who stuck by this community for his for his entire career, for about 50 years or something like that. So I thought, well, the real guy is making it work, so I have to figure out, you know, what that formula is and get it down on the page. So I probably rewrote a lot of the chapters with Donnie. I rewrote those more than anything just to make sure he was on the page. So I'm glad you feel like he made it there.
Oh, he did, definitely. For me, he did. I felt his evolution as a character and how he was coping and you know, just sort of like the play of participation and respect or disrespect from his boss, you know, like the fact that there's one scene where Hugh goes to Puerto Rico and doesn't even tell him he's not going to be in the office for several days, and it was like, no, that's not respectful.
Poor Donnie.
Poor Donnie. I wanted to ask you if you could read a page. This book could have been entirely political or entirely about the mob. But your language and choice of detail really, for me, filled out beautifully a larger sense of the place and time of the story.
Oh, thank you.
There's one page in here, and this is about Donnie and Clara, actually. Could you read this?
Okay.
Yeah, thank you.
Most weekday mornings, Donnie would wake up in the apartment that had been in his family since the 1940s, with Clara there in the bed, though she officially still lived in Maplewood with her parents, and they walked to work together. Today they had toast and coffee, ran combs through their hair, and headed out down Clinton Street, Donnie towards City Hall, and Clara to her job answering phones for the chief of police on Green Street. People pushed past them, headed for desks downtown, the same ones every weekday. Shiny Plymouths sailed in from places like South Orange and Essex, headed to Newark Penn to catch Manhattan trains. For a few minutes, they were all on the street together, some young and soft, some creaking and halting, all hardening with every step into what they would eventually be. Clara's heels clicked on the sidewalk as she and Donnie rounded the corner and headed down Broad Street past Symphony Hall, its incongruous classical columns soaring high up into the hot air. They passed under the marquee advertising the Rolling Stones' upcoming concert, the fourth stop on the scruffy band's second American tour.
Thanks. That's just a tiny little snippet, but I loved that picture of the street and of the people on the street. Yeah, that was wonderful.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay, so another one of your narrators is James Cash. Mm-hmm. And he's a black man who's hired by Donnie to work in the mayor's office. Was he based on any real person?
No, he was based on somebody in my writing group saying, "Where are the black characters?" this wonderful woman, book editor, friend of mine named Kate Sykes, who took me to lunch and said, "All right, this is what you're going to do. Here's what you're going to write this." She said, "Yeah," I had described this story to her so many times that she could really see it in its entirety.
Right.
And so when she started reading drafts from other characters' viewpoints, you know, her response was, "Okay, now let's have, you know, a character from this other point of view." And she said, "You're writing about the riots, right?" And I went, "Yeah, you're right." So I was very glad to be prodded to write from that perspective, because absolutely, I mean, I couldn't write this book without that character.
Sure.
There's no way. Why,
right.
You know, why bother?
Right, right. Yeah.
So that's why. I mean, he needed to be in there. And it was great. It was great fun, and it was a great education to learn to write from that perspective.
Yeah, yeah. One thing that I really liked about him is that James gets his job in the mayor's office sort of in a secondhand way through his brother's activism.
Mm-hmm.
And I liked this little detail because I thought that was very real. You know, sometimes people on the edges of a cause can get pulled in or involved mm-hmm. into something that they really hadn't given a lot of thought before that. So how did you come to have James get involved in that way? Or, you know, I mean, does that just come out of the writing process organically, or did you think ahead of time, okay, well, here's a character, but he's not the guy standing up with the megaphone, or how did you...
I came to it through, you know, I learned a lot about writing itself when I wrote this book, and I learned a lot about writing itself through working with my writing group.
Yeah.
And this importance of scene. And so that is the first approach that I brought to every single chapter was, what happens? Where are the people? What are they doing? And so it's very quickly you realize that even though I'm writing, you know, even though you're writing a chapter from a certain person's point of view, you've got to have people around them for them to interact with. So the first question I asked about James Cash was, where does he live? Does he have a girlfriend? Who does he live with? Does he live with his family? What does his mother think? Because he probably lives with his mother. What is she? Who is she? So I needed to draw her. And what does she think about him being on the street when the riots break out? How does he come to... So it's more like... It's almost like making a movie. You look at the scene that you got to construct and you go, okay, why is that person there? And how did he get there?
Mm-hmm.
And how do the people around him feel about his being there? And so I sort of answered those questions in order to make the scene. And then... So I think that was like the first question that I answered for throughout the book. Who is sitting where? What are they saying? What's around them? What's happening? How does James go from never having met the mayor and his chief of staff to suddenly having a job in their office? How does that work? Well, it's a series of scenes and meetings, and it's really just a matter of putting all the players in their play space.
Yeah.
So that you could get them to where you need to be.
Right.
So
right.
I think I started and ended with scene.
Do you, as you write typically, do you construct chapter by chapter, or do you kind of have a big picture as you start a book, or does that come as you write?
I don't seem to be able to start the writing process, or I haven't with two novels yet, until I know exactly what's going to happen. I spend a lot of time just walking around thinking about it. So, and with this book especially, I really had to start with an outline. I had to know where Donnie was going to end up and where Gloria was going to end up. And I already knew where Hugh ended up.
Right.
And so I had that as sort of a backbone. And then once the story itself, the arc of the story, was sort of firmly implanted in my mind and in my notes, then I could start.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Methodical to a fault.
Is that because of your journalism background? I know you worked...
There's no free writing with me. There's no stream of consciousness. It's all according to a formula.
Mm-hmm.
And until I can see the formula in my head, yeah, I have a hard time expending energy and time on a project because I feel like it's sort of evaporating. You know, if I don't know where I'm going to end up, I'm not going to get in the car and start the trip.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not getting in that car until it's packed and I have a map and I know how long it's going to take me. I have a little bit of a preoccupation with writing and time. And I could probably stand to do a little more free writing exercise, a little more stream of consciousness with writing. But up to now, it's been very, very formulaic.
Mm-hmm. Would your journalism background also, sort of in a parallel question, help you with deadlines, help you with being able to write efficiently once you've started?
It makes it possible.
Yeah.
It really makes it possible. I'm the least creative person I know when it comes to spending my time on creative exploits. Things on my to-do list, if they are not attached to a date, they don't get done.
Yeah.
Because if you don't attach deadlines, and I attach deadlines to everything I do. especially creative work.
Oh, that's really interesting.
And it must come from a journalism background. I mean, I did that as early as I did anything, you know, back when I was in my early 20s. So that's sort of how I learned to be a professional, was in that vein. Things that don't have a firm deadline for me don't get done.
Okay. As I read People Who Hate America, I wondered if you found yourself leaning most on history, on your characters, or on the story you were creating, which, although it closely resembles the history, it is fiction, as you've said. So do you think one of these played a major role in crafting the narrative, history, character, story? Do you think any one of those had more weight, or do you feel like you were able to kind of keep those three balls in the air the whole time?
I was certainly trying to keep all the balls in the air at the same time, but I would also say that the history helped me with the outline,
mm-hmm.
because history just sort of laid out, here's what happened,
right.
and here's a good place to begin my story, and here's a good place to end it. But then I think partly the reason why it took me such a long time to really envision it as a novel, what was happening, I think, in that time of walking around thinking about it, once I knew what had happened historically, it still took me a little while and some prodding to actually sit down and make a novel out of this. But once I did, I was able to relax into the story itself. I had done so much research over so many years that by the time I started writing my fictional novel, I was pretty comfortable. I wasn't running back to do more research. You know, then it became about the characters. So I think at that point it sort of flipped, and I was able to focus on my characters and the story, and I rested assured that I knew what had happened historically. You know, mm-hmm. years of obsessive research will do that.
Yeah.
So it started out historically, and then it became a novel.
Yeah. I enjoyed the way the book looks at the role of women during this time period. We talked a little bit about this when we talked about Gloria. I was thinking about how we've all sort of had Mad Men in our recent backgrounds to help us understand how awful things were for women in a certain time period.
Yeah.
I thought your book shows very subtly the omnipresent sort of lack of fulfillment that a woman might have felt, you know, being just sort of wedged into a role, whether or not she wanted that role.
Mm-hmm.
Without a lot of respect or support, you know. And that doesn't mean that Gloria and Hugh don't have a nice relationship for that time period.
Right.
So that was also something interesting, because side by side we have a woman who's not necessarily feeling entirely fulfilled in her life, not very happy, mm-hmm. right? On the other right. hand, she seems very much in love with her husband,
mm-hmm.
you know, and they seem to have a nice relationship for that time period. And I thought, well, that's an interesting thing to be able to do well. So I wonder if you can talk a little bit about that.
And as you were asking the question too, I was thinking, you know, as I've been researching this character, and I did a little bit of research into Hugh's wife, but she, who had a completely different name and life. But mostly I made up Gloria, sort of out of whole cloth, you know. And I did that as I was turning myself from, you know, early 30s to late 30s to early 40s to now my late 40s, right? So I've been able to grow along with these characters, and I think Gloria mirrors a little bit sort of my own view of marriage, not the depression part, because she's kind of depressed.
Yeah.
But just this view of, okay, well, I'm 48 now. This is where I am. I'm not going to make any changes. I'm here of my own volition. I have 6 wonderful children. It's a little much to keep up with. You know what I mean? But
my mother-in-law lives with us.
Right. Right. So I just, again, I think I probably just pretended like I was her while I was writing about her. And I didn't have, you know.
Bummed you out.
Yeah. It was hard to do. And, you know, it's not like, the only thing I really say is that I did not set out to go, oh boy, Gloria must be really depressed. Mm-hmm. She's stuck in that house. Oh my God, poor thing. but she ended up that way just by walking around her house and sort of musing on her condition. You know, she walks past mirror. She ends up being somebody who walks past mirror and she doesn't look at herself in the mirror because she hasn't had time to get a haircut and she probably doesn't have makeup on and none of her pretty dresses from when she was 20 fit anymore. You know, that would make anybody a little, you know, but it's also, that's the stuff that happens to us when we get older, mm-hmm. you know, whether we're wildly happy in our marriages or not.
Right.
And it was a little surprising to me that Gloria comes off as so depressed, but, you know, yeah. there you have it.
Right.
This is what happened.
It's just how you, yeah. If I could, I want to read a little paragraph.
Okay.
This is just something that I thought was a really interesting way. Sometimes it's hard to find interesting ways, new, different ways to show a character. Mm-hmm. And I love this. She's talking about some of the friends that she has who are really mostly the wives of her husband's associates, right? Mm-hmm. Then there was Marie, Tony's wife. Gloria had known her forever, saw her at least every third Sunday for dinner, but they weren't really close. Marie was brash with a blonde bouffant and wore polyester pantsuits that swished when she walked. Gloria pictured shopping with Marie, trying to focus on finding a dress, while Marie loudly denigrated her three children, her husband, her scary, domineering father-in-law. And then she thought about lunching downtown with Marie to more of the same. Sometimes, when she had to shout at the dinner table to be heard above the din of young children, Gloria reminded herself of Marie, and the comparison stung. She would not call Marie. I love this, partly because we have such a nice little snapshot of this person who's, you know, a regular part of her life, but not an important part to the book. But
yeah.
But also that moment where she recognizes herself when she's yelling at her kids as being like Marie, and
yeah.
it stings. And I thought, what an interesting way to have some self-insight, you know, for this character to have some self-insight.
Thank you.
But and then one other woman that I just want to touch on briefly, because what a great scene. Dolly Sinatra is in this book, right? So she was, what was her civic role? She was a...
So she helped Italian immigrant women
okay.
with their citizenship status.
Okay.
And she was also a ward boss.
A ward boss.
And she was very formidable, you know, and at least one group thought that she performed or helped Italian immigrant women get illegal abortions.
Oh.
So she seemed to be like a fixer for these young women.
Wow.
And she was very, 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 very powerful within like Hoboken.
Yeah.
So it's so, I mean, I just thought, how fun. You know, Gloria's going to go to a dinner. It's Frank Sinatra. So there's this whole excitement about Frank Sinatra, but they're really there.
Yeah.
Everybody's there to pay homage to Dolly Sinatra, who, at least in my telling, comes off as a really horrible person.
Well, you know, I thought in your telling, she came off as just one more example of Hugh just not being there for Gloria, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, there's this moment where he has the opportunity to introduce Gloria to Dolly Sinatra and to, you know, put his arm around his wife and say, you know, this is me. You know, you need to accept my family. And instead, he allows her to be ostracized by this witchy woman, mm-hmm. whether or not this woman was witchy or not. But, you know, like, I thought that was a really nice moment in the book.
Thank you.
Maybe not for Dolly Sinatra's memory. But who knows? You know, maybe she was a lovely woman having a bad night. Who knows? But
well, I wanted to spend a minute, too, with, you know, what's the wife's real role?
Mm-hmm.
Would Hugh have necessarily, in the real life, introduced his wife to, you know, a ward boss from Hoboken? Why? You know, from his perspective, why?
Right, right.
She's just there. I brought her along to see Frank Sinatra. You know, aren't you happy? You know?
Yeah, right.
I don't imagine that Hugh's real wife was used to being, you know, really treated as a professional equal. You know? And she doesn't expect it, really. She goes out and she gets a beautiful dress, and she has a nice time. And when she puts out her hand to, you know, to meet Dolly Sinatra, there's a moment of, oh, that's right, yeah, I'm just the wife. Okay, yeah, never mind.
Yeah. That was a great scene.
Thank you. I thought
that whole party gave you such opportunity to present Gloria, you know, in a lot of different ways.
Well, I got to get her drunk. It's always fun to get drunk. Then they get really depressed.
Can you talk about something large or small that changed in the evolution or revision of this book? I'm trying to ask more questions about revision because I think it's huge.
Yeah, there was... I paid a lot of attention to the scenes I didn't want to write. Like, and I, you know, I just kept putting it off and kept putting it off. And I had decided early on that there was going to be this big break between Donnie, the character of Donnie, and his girlfriend. That she was going to make this grand point, you know, how can you work for this corrupt person? See what you've done.
Mm-hmm.
I'm leaving you, you know. And it, that played really well sort of when I was thinking about it and talking to writing group friends about it. But when it came time to actually write it, I thought, I have made characters who wouldn't do this. It's a brash kind of a TV thing to do. And it's a brash kind of a TV point to make.
Well, and also she works for the police.
Right.
Right, so it would be kind of a hypocritical point to make.
Right, and I started to think about, and it's kind of in the background, because I'm not sure I was super aware of it at the time, but... You know, the kind of breakup where you stand up and you say, I don't believe in what you're doing and I'm leaving, you know, that only happens on TV. You know, and I had gone to such lengths to make these characters believable that I, by that point in the book, and it's the very last part of the book, I went, why am I so bent on having her do this? She wouldn't do it. You know, this, and my characters by that point were so real to me that I was like, oh, yeah, she wouldn't do that. That's stupid.
Yeah.
And so I didn't have her do anything at all, and she just sort of fades away, which is what really happens in real life. You know, if somebody's got a problem with you, they're not going to make a grand pronouncement. Most of the time, they're just going to recede.
Yeah.
And you have to go after them and find out why they receded. It might be because, well, I don't agree with the choices that you've made.
Mm-hmm.
And it just seems so much more realistic to just let these characters do what they wanted to do.
Yeah, and that's really good advice for looking at revision, because by the time you come to a revision, you probably do or should know who your characters are, and then let them be the people you've created, unless it's for some reason not working, and then you probably have to look at them again. But yeah, okay, great. You just said something a minute ago that made me think this is an appropriate question now. Mainly regarding Italian organized crime and the mob, I wonder if you can talk about avoiding stereotypes while remaining true to the culture that creates them. I felt like you did a really good job in this book. These characters are very familiar to me, but of course stereotype is based on a real culture.
Yeah.
So did you think about that while you were working on this?
Well, you know, as far as the mob people went,
right.
I really stand on David Chase's shoulders, you know, and that community in that part of New Jersey has been covered really well, you know, by reality TV and by David Chase and there's a lot of writers too in that area writing about this life. And they do a really good job of presenting that community and those individuals how they really are. So it's the character of a mob guy, it's, you know, just all I have to do is say those words to you, and you have a vision in your mind of what that person looks like and talks like anyway. Right, so I really didn't, I didn't have to do much. All I really had to do was try to point this, you know, give a really nice look into their inner lives, you know, because you can already tell how they're dressed. I don't have to say how they're dressed because you know how mob people dress from TV and movies and Martin Scorsese. So I thought what I really have to do, and the reason David Chase is so successful with The Sopranos is he showed how these people live and what they think, and oh, they're just like us, you know. And
but also put them in situations where we don't expect to see them, like therapy.
Right, right. So I have this mob character who has to wear a wire, right. Which, A, yes, it sounds like it's straight out of The Sopranos, but it's actually straight out of the real historical life of a guy who was an associate of Hugh Adonisio's.
Okay.
Also had to wear a wire. So it was really easy for me. You have a really big, tall mob guy who has to wear a wire. So suddenly he can't talk to his friends anymore. He can't talk to his wife anymore. And all you really have to do as a writer is put that guy in a scene and describe how he feels about that, and you're done.
Yeah. Right. Sure. Yeah, because there's a certain amount that the reader really does already know.
Yep.
Yeah. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about writing violence. Was this difficult? I thought you did it really well, and I was like, wow, the rest
you.
Of this book doesn't necessarily make me think that this author would write violence well, or not well, or whatever. It was not a part of the rest of the book. But
again, I think scene. You know, I really forced myself to think about what I was writing would look like as a movie. And I went back time and time again to add detail so that the reader didn't have to fill stuff in. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think if you're reading a violent scene, there is a certain amount as a reader that you're going to fill in. So I didn't really focus on like what the blood looked like when they're beating the guy up, but I was a bit aware that I had to do some mechanics. So I had two cars on the street, and one of them stops, and then the police car pulls up next to him, and the guys in the police car get out, and they pull the other guy out of his car, they beat him up, and then they drag him up the steps to the police station, which they're parked right in front of. So that's a lot of mechanics. You got to figure out how to get two guys out of the car to the other car, pull the guy out. They got to do something to him that makes him not able to walk. Then they have to pick him up and drag him up the steps while people watch. So all I really did in that scene was describe that logistically. Mm-hmm. And then I took a look at, okay, who's watching and where are they standing? I'm not in their point of view, so I don't really worry. I kind of do that later. And so again, I just tried to make a scene that was believable,
right.
That had enough of the point of view characters' insight as to what was happening, which is kind of horror. I wrote that scene where the police officers beat up the cab driver from the perspective of one of the police officers who doesn't really know what's going to happen, and then it happens, and then he's dealing with his own thoughts. You know, oh my God, this is not good. Is he dead or not? I can't tell. So by the time you get do all that, you've got your scene constructed, and you kind of it's. I didn't think of it as a violent scene. I thought of it as how do I get the guy up the stairs.
Hmm.
And again, this is a scene. This is one of the first things I found out 10 years ago about how these riots broke out. It broke out with two cops and one cab driver, and they nearly killed him, and a bunch of people watched it all happen. I found out stuff about on the internet about that night 10 years ago.
Okay.
So I didn't get hung up by the violence of it. I knew it really, really well.
Yeah.
I knew it as well as if I had watched it happen.
Yeah. Right.
I'm not sure if that answers the question or not, but
it does.
It's like writing sex scenes. Somebody told me I had to write a sex scene. Not for this book. And a friend of mine said, don't even focus on the sex, just focus on the clothes. Focus on the clothes coming off and the mechanics of what happens, and don't psych yourself out by saying, I'm writing a sex scene, I don't know how to do that. you focus on the mechanics, and a lot of times that'll get it done. Okay. And then you got your writing group to say, I don't think this works, I don't think that works, and you know, and then you can go back and fill in detail if you need to.
Okay. All right. My last question is, what advice might you have for writers who are trying to depict an historical event, and maybe even real people living or dead in their fiction? And as an addendum to that question, I'm wondering if you see People Who Hate America as historical fiction, genre-wise.
I do see it as historical fiction, because I think it borrows very heavily from both those terms.
Right.
I just loved the process of taking something that I felt like I had read so much about and understood as well as it was possible to understand, and sort of dealing with those unknowns as fiction. It's a really nice sort of alchemic process for telling a story.
Mm-hmm.
I think it might be, certainly to this point, it is the only way that I've seen my way towards writing two novels. I really have had to start out with a more or less complete picture, and then I write about it almost journalistically, you know? It's a great way to do it. And I feel like, you know, sort of my watchword for People Who Hate America was to try to treat these characters with respect. And I would love to think that I could send the people who are—I haven't done it yet. You know, I'm a little shy. But there are people, there are real people who I've depicted in that book. I'd like to think that if they read it, they would see themselves and see that they were treated respectfully, mm-hmm. and I think kindly. That's my hope.
Okay. I'm going to just say one more time. Kim McQueen, People Who Hate America. Thank you very much. I really enjoyed speaking with you.
Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Kim McQueen. You can learn more about her work at her websites, kimmcqueen.com, and also barnesmcqueen.com, which is the site she shares with her business partner, fellow publishing consultant, Cindy Barnes. You can hear an earlier interview with Kim and Cindy about that aspect of their work in the Write the Book archives from February 2014. Write the Book and The Radiator are supported in part by Main Street Landing, creating places for people to work, play, entertain, meet, eat, and greet on Burlington's beautiful waterfront. Main Street Landing rents office and retail space as well as daily rentals for meetings, events, and performances in their Performing Arts Center. Contact Melinda at 802-864-7999 for more information. You can also go to mainstreetlanding.com. Write the Book's also brought to you by Calamity and Crowe's Trading Post, twisting fresh tie-dyes for individuals, businesses, and organizations with standards like eyeballs, Jerry Bears, peace signs, and their signature tie-dyed mule. Custom artisan tie-dyes that rock. Contact Calamity and Crowe's Trading Post on Facebook. This week's Write the Book prompt is to write about a familiar setting but place it in a different time period. If you write about that place in the past, do some research. Try to find pictures or interviews that shed light on what the area was like. But also use your imagination. The fact that you know the place means that you can bring something to it from experience that might add warmth to the snapshot or the wiki entry that you have used for research. Perhaps in a photograph you can learn that a simple boathouse existed on the shore of your favorite bay. You already know what the water sounds like there, how the breezes feel, and what direction they tend to move in. So describe the old boathouse using your photo that you found online, but describe the place in full using experience and emotional connection. And then, of course, if you launch your setting into the future, you can take a lot more license, but still try to stay honest to what you feel might change and might stay the same about your special place. Good luck with this exercise, and please listen next week for another. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know they can stream it live at theradiator.org every Monday from 2 to 3. Archived episodes of Write the Book are on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and Write the Book Radio Show on Facebook for updates. You can also access the podcast and my new blog, The Silent G, by going to my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. If you have a guest to suggest or comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. And finally, do remember that this station is here thanks to community support and involvement. More information about the Radiator is available online at theradiator.org. This has been Write the Book. I am Shayla Shapiro, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM, LP, Burlington, Vermont.